do something rather introductory and leave us with some questions. And this afternoon when we come back at 2:15 after lunch and after we've gone to 43rd Street, we're going to have a chance to come up here again and really look at the Cain and Abel relationship and also deal with it on a very current and historical basis. This is not merely the day to speak about Cain and Abel, but the day to speak about Cain and Abel moving into the children's era. So I'd like to begin this morning to just go back and to speak a little bit about the relationship. I'm not going to go into all of the, what to say, the fundamental doctrines of the relationship or fundamental points, because I feel like you know those for the most part anyway. But I want to speak a little bit about just the relationship itself. First of all, Cain and Abel is a restorative relationship. This is my own term, by the way. But just to start us out. And what I mean by that, very simply, is that Cain and Abel, as we know it today, never should have existed in God's original scheme, in his original way of creation. Surely Cain, as the elder brother, would be the one who would take the most honored inheriting position, and Abel would be simply the younger brother. And that would be very natural. Even in our physical families, we find that that's what exists generally, is that the older brother takes a greater responsibility, is looked up to. Even in my own family, I know our eldest son is sort of the chief around the house for the little one. But in the Cain and Abel relationship, we find that the second son takes the lead, so to speak. And this, frankly speaking, is not according to the original plan of God. And it's not according either to our original nature. Not originally. The word original keeps coming up. Not originally speaking. But this relationship suddenly becomes necessary after the fall when we're speaking of the need for restoration. The parents and the archangel made a failure. They goofed and made a big mistake. And so, as a result, the children are thrown into this difficult position of Cain and Abel relationship, centering on Abel. Thrown into a very difficult position. And so, to really realize this relationship between Cain and Abel, it's truly historical. And as we look back through history and realize in our own lives the Cain and Abel relationship, the very same struggles that these two sons of Adam and Eve had, then sons and daughters of Adam and Eve, very, very far removed. Today, you and I, we go through the same things that they went through and that we read about in the Bible and in history time and again. So, Cain and Abel is a restorative relationship. It's not originally intended, but only after the fall did it come into being. It was a problem of the parents that was passed on to the children. Children had to take responsibility for what the parents couldn't do. And finally, the very same struggles of Cain and Abel come to you and I today. It's historical. Very fundamental points and basic. There are some questions we could ask about the Cain and Abel relationship. For example, why didn't God just sort of eliminate Adam and Eve and make some other parents that could take care of Cain and Abel? I know it's a silly question, but why? I mean, back at that time, why didn't God just erase them off the board, Adam and Eve, and write in a new pair of parents that could, you know, whatever. Huh? Yeah, that's, yeah, of course. Herman? Okay. Good and loud. Anybody has an answer? Yeah, that's coming closer.
Also, it seems like, this is going one step further, but it seems like after Cain and Abel had made their unity, there would have had to be some vertical unity between their parents in order to make the Messiah. So, to destroy the parents means, part of the failure of the Cain-Abel relationship was Eve's failure to take responsibility. So actually, if Cain and Abel had been successful, then the whole family as a unit would have been successful and accomplished the necessary conditions to move the Messiah. Not just Cain and Abel, but actually Adam and Eve were also still involved in the process.
Mm. In a sense, you're saying then that by the son's achievement, the parents could have been saved.
Not just that by the son's achievement, but that the son's achievement would have been the parents' achievement also.
Yeah. Right.
Just left alone, certainly what would have happened. Mm-hmm. But if the parents had recognized their relationship and dealt correctly with the relationship of Cain and Abel, then they would have been able to help them to unite, and the whole family as one unit would have come through the children, but all together as one.
Right. Actually, what you're saying is true and clear, and I just want to mention and apply this, that very simply, before the Messiah can come, the children's position has to be, in a way, worked out. Or, in other words, the Cain and Abel relationship has to be worked out and has to be successful, because otherwise you've got no foundation for him. That's what we study, practically speaking. In other words, before the parents come, those children that were defiled through the fall have to work out vertically and horizontally their defilement or whatever their situation, so that they'll be in a position to welcome the true parents. We'll refer to the Messiah as true parents here. And so the children have to, in a sense, take responsibility for that. In other words, before the perfect can come, we have to take responsibility for the imperfect. Before that perfect can come, there has to be some responsibility then for the imperfect situation. And I think if we bring it up to this point, right now, let's jump out of the story of Cain and Abel and come back to this time right now. Think of modern Christianity or modern fundamental Christianity. Here are many, many people waiting for the coming of the Messiah and dreaming about him when he comes, and actually many churches believing that he will come and recognize their church as the church to come back to. Or, on the other hand, waiting for the Messiah but not considering the foundation to receive him. When Jesus comes, he'll come. And there's no sense about clearly what has to be done to prepare for him. Now let's jump ahead again and apply it to us. We too wait and long for the Messiah very often. We know he's here, and we want to see him, or we want to know him, want to, whatever, relate with him, and love that these true parents of ours. But the point is that we cannot fully receive them and understand them and relate with them until we have a success in this Cain and Abel relationship in our lives. A real success, not just physically uniting or cooperating in a working relationship, but really coming to the heart of that relationship at some point. And the question is, have we experienced that level of working that Cain and Abel relationship? The point, again, is that true parents are perfect. And again, I echo to you what I mentioned yesterday. Someone saying, well, I really love God and true parents, but I really have a hassle with my Abel figure. Now, that may be. And the Abel figure may be very immature, or very narrow, or very judgmental, or whatever. But whatever it is, as I said, until we can come to terms with the imperfect reality around us, we can't really receive the perfect or make a place to really come into a true union with our true parents. If we look at, again, a world full of people waiting for Jesus today, the feeling oftentimes is, oh, this world is such hell, it's so awful, I can hardly wait. Jesus will come and save us and lift us out. I've heard that same kind of thing expressed about true parents. I'm having a hell of a time in this center. It's just terrible. If only Father can understand my heart and lift me out of this place. You ever heard that? Isn't it the same? And again, at the end, it is, well, I love true parents and I love God, but I just can't stand this situation. And I think we have to realize that that's coming very close to fundamental Christians' ideas about Jesus, what he's going to come and do, come and save everybody, no matter what the situation. But fact is, without a foundation and without a mature reception of our true parents in ourselves and in our situations and so on, they cannot do that much. For example, they live a few miles from here, a few miles from New York City. And here we have 1,000 members. Now, what we make here among our 1,000 people in New York City is not according to Father's magic desire and will. He can say something, and we'll cooperate and go ahead. But in terms of our relationships, there's no magic. There is a principle. There is a principle. And to really make that place for Father to be received and to make a place where Father can come and get something accomplished, there is a deep responsibility on our parts. The same thing with, again, waiting for Jesus for historical Christianity. The idea that Jesus is going to come and just sort of save everybody, whether they like it or not, or by force, or snatch a few and ban the other ones, is just completely ridiculous. So, it's something to think about. I've known brothers and sisters to see Father for the first time after a long time, and actually been disappointed. Maybe they never saw him before, and they came and they were waiting for someone who's going to come and literally kind of sweep them up and, wow, you know, salvation. And they saw Father, and I checked with them. This is in the 40-day workshop. Over many times I'd ask, how did you feel? And they say, oh, and then more than one time someone said, finally, after kind of making a lot of little words, kind of chewing their tongues for a while, I didn't feel so much. Or someone actually said one time, I was kind of let down. Is that Father's fault? Well, on one hand, maybe somebody's got this idea that Father's going to come in with, you know, a 6-foot thick aura that everyone can see, you know. Or that they were expecting to have some spiritual experience when they saw him. Or whatever. And it didn't happen. Of course, there are expectations. And who could blame anybody for having expectations like that? After all, we're talking about the person who's taking the messianic role. So, you know, that's natural. I know when I first saw him too, I was expecting, as I said, to be struck down by his gaze almost. But on the other hand, I think there is something here to be thought of, and that is that if one who is just seeing Father for the first time or coming into the first relationship with Father for the first time has come out of a very chaotic situation in terms of this Cain and Abel relationship, then there's been no foundation for really appreciating Father. Now, isn't it true of Christianity's relationship with Father? There's no foundation for appreciating him because of the failure, again, of the Cain and Abel principle there. The children have not really succeeded in preparing and uniting with parents. So there is this unreal expectation. And so when the real man comes, oh, we're disappointed. He says he's the Messiah. He's a fake. Because expecting, again, 600-foot Jesus coming down from the clouds. Unreal expectations. And I believe we get caught by the same things as the things we accuse the fundamental Christians for. Because we didn't make a foundation either. Very often, it's true. If we, I think if we recognize the meaning of Cain and Abel relationship, we've got to look at a number of points this morning. Number one is that it's really our opportunity, both the one in the Cain position and the one in the Abel position, to assume responsibility for ourselves before God and before one another. And very often we have misunderstood this relationship and seen it more in terms of position. And this is a problem. Again comes the old question, well, Cain should serve Abel. No, Abel should serve Cain. No. And back and forth, so on. And who's right, and all of these things come up. Simply, without understanding the relationship and without understanding our responsibility outside and inside, as I say, then we can't expect to really be able to be saved, as they say, by Father. And we will have to go on, perhaps even after we're blessed, to come to understand the meaning of salvation through the Messiah. Continuously going through this experience of Cain and Abel until we really catch the meaning of it and the significance of it and the responsibility that it demands. And so this position, I think, of Cain and Abel, this relationship of Cain and Abel is ultimately demanding what I'd call a responsible heart on our parts. I'm going to come back to that in a minute, but I'd like to just bring another point. asking or wanting very much the position of Abel and deploring or feeling bad about the position of Cain really tells us a lot about where we are. I think many times you or I know, have run into the situation where somebody really wants the Abel position and really doesn't like this idea of the Cain position, and it's just got all this feeling about it. Oh, you're in the Cain position. But the very fact of wanting that Abel position so much, or looking down on the Cain position, shows the ignorance of that whole relationship. The ignorance of that whole relationship. Both positions are extremely significant and precious. So I'd like them to speak about some issues of Cain and Abel going into the children's age. First of all, what I just mentioned, loving the position of Abel and really not so much loving the position of Cain, is primarily the reaction of archangels, because they really get into position. It's an archangelic reaction. And it just simply proves that two archangels are trying to take position of sons. And hopefully, in the position of sons, those archangels can finally become sons or daughters. And this is, I think, critical, looking into the children's age right now. I think we're living at a time where all of us in this room are aware that position is definitely not the value. The savior of our movement is the dishwasher. We need to think about that. Okay, if we talk about the children's era and the Cain and Abel relationship, then immediately, I know, if you got a hold of Father's speech, Children's Day, 1981, then someone may say, wait a minute, we don't even need this lecture because the age of Cain and Abel is over. It's over. And this is the age of member-centered movement. This is the age of love and individual love and so on. So forget this Cain and Abel thing. You better change the program of the 120-day training. Well, I got bad news for you. I'm not going to do it. We have to spend a whole day on this thing. It's not quite that simple that we just erase the whole Cain and Abel reality. And I think many times Father's words can be dangerous because they can be misinterpreted. You know, Father's words are powerful, and they can be sort of bent around very creatively and molded to the situation. We are, in a respect, of course, still living in an age where the Cain and Abel relationship is extremely important. For example, if it's member-centered movement, let's knock out all the structure. For example, Salo, forget all the hierarchical structure in Salo. Everybody comes equal. No managers, no leaders, whatever. MFT, knock out all the structure, no leaders. Just put a few chocolate bars on everybody's hand and say, this is a member-centered MFT. Forget this Cain-Abel hierarchy. This, anyway, go out and sell chocolate bars. Good luck. Pioneer. And you can have a lot of struggle. Yeah. Or home church, too. Even home church, which is ultimately coming down to the individual, there's still a need for some kind of structure to get the thing moving. And it all involves these Cain and Abel relationships. So, if the answer or if the question is it necessary in this children's era, or can we kind of turn our backs on it? The answer is it is necessary, and we cannot turn our backs. And you may say, well, that's, I know that already. There are a lot of people who don't. I've heard some interesting things being said after Father's speech, 1981, in October. So, okay, then let's go back again to the past. It is still necessary, but let's look at the Cain and Abel relationship. And I want to just present some issues at this point. And I'm not going to be long this morning. I'm just, as I say, kind of throwing some things at you. And later on this afternoon, when we get together, we can have a good discussion. And then there are a few more things that I want to go into this afternoon about Abel and then Cain. I think we've all been veterans of many problems in the Cain-Abel relationship. I think all of us, too, have had good experiences. Here, how many of you have had a significantly good experience in a Cain-Abel relationship? Yeah. How many have had a significantly difficult experience at times? So it's all the same people. Yeah, it's not consistent. Me, too. Many times. But I do, of course, want to speak essentially about the problems this morning, because those are the things we're concerned about. A good relationship, that's finished, it's good, it's great. But let's look at some of the difficulties. For example, through talking with many members over the years, just to break it down most simply, you've got the problem of the Cain who just cannot follow anybody. Person is just convinced that they have got what's needed. They don't need this leader at all. Heck with the guy. Maybe this Cain person is much more gifted than the leader. Extremely thoughtful, very bright, sharp. The leader's kind of dull. And so I don't need this guy. He slows down my pace. Or the Cain that has just got this incredibly independent kind of character. Now, this is one problem. And someone who's been a leader comes and says, what can I do about this person? They're all over the place. I don't know how to get together with them. We can't even sit down and talk without this person jumping up, heading out somewhere. Another problem, Cain unable to follow. Okay, another problem, Abel unable to lead. Why? Any number of reasons. Because of the situation, perhaps, and suddenly this person finds themselves leading a situation they cannot even get a grasp on. Or the problem of insecurity in the position. I was very happy as a follower working with somebody else, supporting. Absolutely, I could be happy. I felt like I was in the position I'd been waiting for all my life, working and supporting. And now I find myself in a leadership position and I feel like I'm standing naked at the North Pole. And I feel very insecure. What should I do? Well, that's a problem. And then, of course, the position struggles. The matter where for example, Abel stands up one morning and there's a little problem and he looks at the person who follows him and says, remember, I'm Abel and you're Cain. That always brings a wonderful reaction. There's that difficulty. Position struggles. And it's, I think, will agree unanimously that it is an ugly thing to watch when people are jockeying for position and power, because it looks like a political game. And yet, I'll bet you a significant number of us have done it. either inside or outside, blatantly. And yet we don't like to see that kind of thing. It happens sometimes. Or, on the other hand, you've got an Abel-Cain relationship that's a pretty good working relationship. They get along okay. And they get their job done every day. But inside, on the inside of that relationship, even though they work together well, there's no communication. And there's frustrations building up in both of them. Because they can't sit down and really share on a deeper level than just getting the work done every day. And we live in a movement where there's a lot of work to do. There's a lot of pressure. There is much to be accomplished every day. And so it's very easy to say, well, we ought to go out somewhere together. That happened Friday night with us, the staff. You all went out in your groups. Taj and Jim and Taco and I were all going to go out to a movie or something. Our little group. But fateful time comes Friday evening. Taco and I walk up to Taj and Jim and say, we're sorry, we got to study for tomorrow because we have to give the presentation. It happens a lot of times. And so it's okay. But if it goes on in a long pattern and there never is that inner communication, then pretty soon there'll be a blow-up. Sooner or later there will be a blow-up. Even though it seemed to be working very well. And somebody will say, wait a minute, we have a good working relationship. What's this? What are you getting caned out about? We've always got the work done. I mean, I thought everything was okay. Well, there were some simple human considerations that were forgotten. That's a problem, too, especially in a busy, high-pressure restoration movement like Unification Church. So there are many, many things to discuss and to talk about. I mean, Taco told me last night after she gave her talk on the love problems, we were just talking about how many different things you could go into if you wanted to get into the whole field. And yet we felt, well, it's better just to open up a few doors and then let's work on it together as a group. So I feel almost this way myself this morning. To make a few fundamental points, open up a few doors, and then let's go this afternoon. And there's a lot to discuss. So I hope you don't expect the definitive answers from me this morning, because you won't get them. Something for us to remember is that we have spent most of our lives in an archangelic age. If we think of our age and the children's age, we're all still in diapers. This children's age started, as I understand, officially May 16th, 1981, right after Yejinim was blessed. It was really like the official beginning. Okay, that means we're all still wetting our pants. Sorry to put it in graphic terms like that. But that's where we're at in terms of being the children. But in terms of the archangelic, well, we're 26, 27 years old. Now that's enough time for most people to get their basic character formed as an adult. So we have lived most of our lives in the archangelic age. We've been born into the children's age just recently. And so you can see how simply one date on the calendar doesn't change you from an archangel to a child. Right? And that really coming into this children's age, remember, we're being born out of the old age into the new. So it's like coming from darkness into light. There's still a lot of darkness at the back. Even though the eyes see the light, there is still darkness coming from behind. And the transition, it's not just dark to light. Did you ever see a day dawn where it's suddenly dark and suddenly the sun goes whoop, light? No way. There's a slow gray light that comes, just barely able to be detected. It even looks like a street light at first. And then it comes a little brighter, and pretty soon you realize the dawn is going to be here in another hour or so. And that's kind of like the children's age coming to, a dawn. And we're, in a sense, in the gray light right now. I don't think the sun has risen yet where we can see everything clearly. And that's why in this transition between, you might say, the dark ages and the age of light that our true parents have brought, in this transition stage, our values get turned upside down very often and knocked all over the place. I know many Moonies who thought they understood things very well and very clearly, and now are watching all the conceptions get turned upside down. And it's extremely disrupting in a human life. I've watched quite a few of my fundamental sacred beliefs in the last couple of years get knocked on their backsides. And I thought, wait a minute, I thought I had that one figured out eternally. And now suddenly my wonderful model is getting busted up. Anyone had this experience in the last year or two? I know particularly if you're coming out of a life where you've held one mission long time and your life is centered around that mission, and now you're being moved to a completely different mission. New mission, new age. You know things are going to get tossed all over the place. Even same mission, new age. Things get tossed around. Being in education, I get in on all of the, sorry to say the word, heavenly gossip in the movement. Everything comes running through. Workshop by workshop, or just, you know, being in the education department, it's like an anthill of information. People, you know, going on and on day by day. And, you know, here I can understand a lot about what's happening in England now, because here Richard Thomas is here and a few other English people, David, and so on. And we sit down and talk. And naturally what they share is their experience in England. Someone else here from somewhere else, or some of the mission and everything, I can pick up a lot. And naturally, I don't like the idea of just gossiping and passing it around, but simply, an educator needs to be educated all the time. A person in an education position needs education day by day. You can never, ever say, now I'm the teacher. So I'll tell you, I listen. I really do a lot of listening to find out what's going on, because I recognize that if our training sessions are not in contact with that reality, what are we doing? And so I find out that even in one section of the movement, maybe in one mission, there's a lot of upheaval going on, let alone changing from one mission to another. One particular section of the movement, big upheavals. And someone says, oh, it's terrible, what's happening? I say, it's not terrible, it's great. Because our status quo is getting challenged. I'll tell you, who brings more upheaval in this movement than anybody else is the man who leads it. Reverend Sun Myung Moon doesn't let anybody get a fat butt in this movement. Sorry to put it in those terms on Sunday morning, but he doesn't like people sitting down, getting comfortable in their identity, their way of doing things or whatever. The last conference I was at, my whole stomach was shaking for a solid hour because I saw him take all these comfortable state leaders and change every last one of them. By doing what? I thought, from my past experience, he looks at each one and analyzes and thinks, and they discuss, and so on. Okay, so-and-so go here, and so here. Last time, he put all the names in the hat. And there were some leaders who were very comfortable and doing a very good job in their states. In fact, I was talking to one just before the conference, and he was telling me, you know, about all the things that he was planning for his state, and he's absolutely had a very good success there. At least by our standards, he's doing very well. And so confident, you know, and with the briefcase and the nice suit. really the mark of the smell of success, you know. The sweet smell of success. Anyway, so at the conference, Father says, well, we got to make some changes. You know, and Father was really pacing that day, just like a lion. We have to make some changes. And he said, okay. And then he spoke a little more, and then he said, okay, all the state leaders, get up and go over to that side of the room. And all these fellows, I looked at this one guy that had been smelling sweetly. And the chin was shaking a little bit, you know. And then I looked over there at all these guys, and everyone just looked like just sheepish, kind of this way. And then Father said, okay, write all the numbers on a map. And the person who was writing was nervous, because Father said, get it, that's not, go on, do it, that's it. And so I wrote all the numbers out on the map, threw them in a box on the states. And Father said, okay, come on, one by one, pick out a number. And the numbers corresponded to different states. So the couple that had in charge of the whole Los Angeles church gets sent to Rhode Island. The man in charge of Chicago goes to Vermont. Vermont. Anybody here from Vermont? I'm glad, because I want to say something about Vermont. Vermont. There's nothing moving up in Vermont. People have been living the same way up there for the last 300 years. It's true. Burlington, Vermont. It's really the elbow of the United States. Way out there. I really praise that brother. Patrick Hickey. He went to Burlington, Vermont from Chicago. One brother who had a major city and who was doing very well. Afterwards, he was going to another place where there's like two members in the center. And I said, well, how is it? And he was pink and kind of shaking, and we're good friends. And he said, it sounded like a little kid going to children's camp. He said, could you come and visit me sometime? And so anyway, this is what Father did. And I'm so innocent. At first, I tell you honestly, for a little while I was reacting in myself. I was saying, Father, you didn't understand. These people were having success and you changed them too? What are you doing? And after, it took me a few days to calm down from this kind of, you know, attitude and realize that the man is helping us navigate the changing of eras here. Even though sometimes it seems really almost crazy, wild, what goes on. He's helping us navigate the changing of eras. And he does not want to let us settle down into identities. He's ready to shake it. Shake the box very hard. You know, even though he may lose some success in the city for a while the new fellow, who isn't quite as capable, is getting used to the job. You know. And as I say, if we reflect back then on the Cain and Abel relationship going into a new age and new era, we cannot afford to just sit confidently and say, I know what it means. I don't know what it means myself. I'm trying to find out every day. And I don't think that any of us can afford to say we know what it means. We will know as we get on into it. And so the purpose of this day, as we begin to search together, discuss together, and so on, will be to look at this changing of an era and understand the Cain and Abel relationship, because it has so much to do with the salvation that we can bring to the world. Because the sons and daughters will become the parents in the future. And we're going to pass on a lot. We're the first generation, so to speak. And what we understand or don't understand is tremendously important for the future. And I tell you, it's simply not enough to just receive a nice lecture, get a bunch of notes. It takes work on all of our part. And as I say, 120 days is not anything. the drop in the bucket. It's really having to do with our life experience and how we go about our life every day, what we're looking for, and how, in a way, how unsatisfied we are, too. Do you know what I mean by that? Not to simply be dissatisfied so easily. So, I'm going to leave you with that today. As I said, we started out, we talked about Cain and Abel as a restorative relationship, one which is historical, one which is not normal in terms of God's original plan. We spoke about some of the difficult,